Hi, we are Microwaves, reminding you that the most important things in life are to crush your enemies,
to see them driven before you,
and to hear the lamentations of their women while listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh. No one is as excited about flaming cheese as we are.
Hi, this is Brad Yoder, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
This is Grant Lee Phillips, telling you, if you're wondering where you're tuned to, it happens to be 88.3 FM, radio's finest. WRCT Pittsburgh.
Yo, there's only 6 degrees of separation, and we know 5 people you know. How much longer did you really think you could avoid strict flow? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM like this.
From New York, Rock Raider.
Yeah, yeah, 1-2, Total Eclipse.
From Executioners, and we chilling on WRCT.
Word up, Pittsburgh representing 88.3 FM.
Check
on
it
your
out,
dial. All right? Peace.
Hi, this is Felicia Collins from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
This is WRCT. This is WRCT. Come on and stay with us a while. Big 900 on your dial. We'll make your day a great big smile. WRCT.
Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
CT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
WRCT, the in sound from way out.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we won't respect you in the morning.
Hey there, this is MC Honky, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
This is Mark G. of the Evolution Control Committee, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, where the drunken pants are going wild!
WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We're always here for you.
Yeah, yeah, what's up? This is Total Eclipse.
Word up, Rock Raider from Executioners.
Word up, chilling,
chilling
with
on WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Yeah, yeah, right, 88.3.
Check it out, all right?
Word up, real hip hop.
Yeah, thanks, man.
You don't even have to do the hip hop show.
Oh, we do everything.
RCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we love monkeys.
Soon, pay toilets will take over the world, and everyone, everywhere will listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
You're tuned to WRCT Pittsburgh's automation.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh's radio automation. Please stay tuned for more incredible tracks from our extensive, vast, libidinous, and...
balls.
Awesome. I called it libidinous. It doesn't make any... I mean... it.
This is Satan,
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hey, this is Jim from Rusted Root, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh. Yow.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I'm now in a camp for Afghan refugees outside of Kerman in the center of Iran. There are now more and more people coming from Afghanistan. 3,000 to 5,000 people come every single day. 300,000 since the Taliban takeover at the end of August. So it is urgent to give more support to Iran.
Afghanistan is facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis as millions face starvation with the winter months quickly approaching. We'll speak to Jan Egeland of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's just back from visiting an Afghan refugee camp in Iran. We'll also talk to him about the refugees stranded on the Belarus-Poland border. Then we look at U.S.-China relations and the Biden-Xi virtual summit last night. We'll speak to historian Alfred McCoy. His new book is out today, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change.
By 2030, the world is going to witness an historic transition from U.S. power to Chinese hegemony. For the past 70 years, the world has been ruled by the United States as the most powerful empire in the history of the world. Well, by 2030, China's economy is going to be at least 50% larger than the U.S. economy. Its military is going to be expanding. It's going to be, in many areas, the equal of the U.S. military. And if conflict comes, if a war comes, it's going to come over Taiwan.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden signed the $1.2 trillion Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, legislation hailed by the White House as the largest ever federal investment in U.S. bridges, drinking water, passenger rail, and public transit. Biden signed the bipartisan bill Monday on the South Lawn of the White House, surrounded by lawmakers from both major parties.
The bill I'm about to sign a law as proof that despite the cynics, Democrats and Republicans can come together and deliver results. We can do this.
Progressive lawmakers are demanding Congress swiftly pass an even larger piece of legislation, the 10-year, $1.75 trillion Build Back Better Act to fund social safety net programs and combat the climate crisis. All 50 Republican senators oppose the legislation, meaning it needs the support of conservative Democrats to pass. Last week, West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin cast new doubt on the bill's fate after he said he would oppose tax incentives for electric vehicles produced by union workers. Manchin has also refused to say if he'll back President Biden's pledge at the COP26 climate summit to slash methane emissions by 30% this decade. Biden's proposed a tax on methane as part of the reconciliation package. President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping spoke for 3.5 hours in a virtual summit Monday night. Topics discussed included Taiwan, human rights, and trade policies. During the summit, Xi warned Biden supporting Taiwanese independence would be, quote, playing with fire. He also criticized the U.S. for building new alliances in the Pacific region to counter China's rise. Xi said dividing the world into blocks would, quote, inevitably bring disaster to the world. Biden called on the two nations to develop, quote, guardrails to help avoid possible disagreements from spiraling into conflict.
It seems to me our responsibility as leaders of China and the United States is to ensure that the competition between our countries does not veer into conflict, whether intended or unintended. Just simple, straightforward competition.
We'll have more on the summit later in the broadcast. In Uganda, police say at least three people were killed, nearly three dozen others injured Tuesday after a pair of suicide bomb attacks rocked the capital city, Kampala. One of the blasts struck near Uganda's parliament. Another went off near Kampala's central police station. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. The Islamic State claimed attacks in Uganda last month that killed civilians, including children. Spanish Coast Guard sailors on Monday rescued three dozen refugees in waters near the Canary Islands and recovered the bodies of two others who died during the crossing. Five people with hypothermia were airlifted to a nearby hospital in critical condition. Spain says nearly 17,000 people have made the dangerous journey to the Canary Islands from Morocco or occupied Western Sahara this year, more than double the number who attempted the crossing during the same period last year. In eastern Poland, border guards fired tear gas and water cannons Tuesday at hundreds of asylum seekers who tried to push their way through a razor wire barrier erected along the Poland-Belarus border. Some of the refugees responded by throwing sticks, stones, and bottles at soldiers in riot gear. Many of the migrants have spent weeks enduring freezing temperatures and squalid camps hoping to reach the European Union to apply for asylum. On Monday, the EU threatened new sanctions against Belarus, accusing it of encouraging migrants to cross into Poland in retaliation for earlier sanctions imposed after Belarus cracked down on pro-democracy protests. We'll have more on this story with Jan Egeland of the Norwegian Refugee Council. In Thailand, thousands of people took to the streets of Bangkok Sunday in defiance of a ban on protests after a court ruled calls to reform the Thai monarchy amounted to attempts to overthrow the king. Since 2020, more than 150 people have been charged under a Thai law allowing prison terms of up to 15 years for anyone convicted of defaming Thailand's monarchs. This is one of the protesters.
The word reform is not equivalent to abolition. Authorities want to do only the things they desire and see people with opposing views as the bad guys, so they think that we're trying to topple them. If society continues like this, how could we move forward?
The United States has sharply condemned Russia over what it said was an anti-satellite missile test carried out Monday. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said the missile targeted one of Russia's own satellites. He said the resulting explosion created more than 1,500 pieces of orbital debris large enough to track, plus hundreds of thousands of smaller objects that pose a risk to satellites and astronauts.
Russia's dangerous and irresponsible behavior jeopardizes the long-term sustainability of outer space and clearly demonstrates that Russia's claims of opposing the weaponization of space are disingenuous and hypocritical.
This comes as the U.S., Russia, and China continue to test new hypersonic missiles capable of flying through low Earth orbit to deliver nuclear warheads. President Biden Monday proposed a 20-year ban on oil and gas drilling in and around Chaco Canyon, a site of ancestral significance to indigenous people. The valley in the high desert of northwest New Mexico was at the center of Chacoan culture for about 400 years, beginning in the 9th century. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, who this year became the first ever Native American U.S. Cabinet Secretary, praised the drilling ban. She added, quote, "Now is the time to consider more enduring protections for the living landscape that is Chaco so that we can pass on this rich cultural legacy to future generations." Deb Haaland used to be the Congress member from New Mexico. Vermont Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy announced Monday he will retire when his term ends in 2022. Leahy is 81 years old, chair of the powerful Senate Appropriations Committee, and is the longest-serving senator currently in office. In Texas, Beto O'Rourke said Monday he's running for the Democratic gubernatorial nomination and hopes to unseat incumbent Republican Governor Greg Abbott in 2022. O'Rourke became a high-profile Democratic presidential candidate after he narrowly lost his bid to unseat Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz in 2018. Meanwhile, an analysis of heavily gerrymandered congressional maps proposed by Republican state legislatures since the 2020 census shows redistricting alone is on pace to give Republicans a House majority in the midterm elections. former Trump advisor Steve Bannon turned himself in to the FBI on Monday after being indicted for two counts of contempt of Congress for refusing to comply with a subpoena from the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. Bannon was later released. He's scheduled to be arraigned on Thursday. In Wyoming, the state Republican Party has voted to stop recognizing Congressmember Liz Cheney as a party member due to her vote to impeach Donald Trump for inciting the Capitol insurrection. A spokesperson for Cheney responded by saying it was sad that leaders in the Wyoming Republican Party have, quote, allowed themselves to be held hostage to the lies of a dangerous and irrational man, they said. In other Trump news, the Wall Street Journal reports a Miami investment fund is preparing to purchase the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C. for $375 million and will turn the property into a Waldorf Astoria hotel while removing the Trump name. In labor news, unions representing more than 30,000 Kaiser Permanente healthcare workers on the West Coast and Hawaii called off a strike Monday after winning a tentative contract that boosts wages and sets limits on nurse-to-patient ratios. Union negotiators also beat back a proposal by Kaiser managers to create a two-tiered wage structure that would have seen new hires paid significantly less. Meanwhile, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, IATSE, voted narrowly Monday to approve new film and TV contracts, ending a struggle that nearly saw 60,000 workers strike last month to demand higher pay, guaranteed breaks, and better benefits. A narrow majority of IATSE members actually voted down the larger of the two contracts, but the deal was still ratified after it gained a majority of votes under the union's Electoral College-style voting system. In Kenosha, Wisconsin, jury deliberations begin today in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, the white teenage gunman who fatally shot two people and wounded a third during protests over the police shooting of Jacob Blake in 2020. Rittenhouse faces five felony charges, including first-degree intentional homicide. On Monday, the judge dropped a sixth charge for unlawful weapon possession. During closing arguments, Assistant District Attorney Thomas Binger urged jurors to convict Rittenhouse.
There is no doubt in this case that the defendant committed these crimes. He committed a first-degree reckless homicide against Joseph Rosenbaum. He put Richie McGinnis's life in jeopardy. He put Jumpkick Man's life in jeopardy. He intended to kill Anthony Huber, and he attempted to kill Gage Grosskreutz. All of those elements are true.
During his closing arguments, defense attorney Mark Richards maintained Kyle Rittenhouse had acted in self-defense.
Kyle shot Joseph Rosenbaum to stop a threat to his person. And I'm glad he shot him, because if Joseph Rosenbaum had got that gun, I don't for a minute believe he wouldn't have used it against somebody else. He was irrational and crazy.
As the jury begins deliberations, Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers has put 500 National Guard troops on standby ahead of a verdict. Meanwhile, in Georgia, the trial is continuing for the three white men who hunted down and shot dead Ahmaud Arbery, a black jogger. On Monday, Judge Timothy Walmsley rejected a request from defense attorneys to declare a mistrial. The judge also said it was, quote, reprehensible for the defense to object to allowing black pastors sit with Arbery's family in the courtroom. Last week, defense attorney Kevin Goff said, quote, we don't want any more black pastors coming in here. He cited the presence of the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who hadn't actually attended the trial. On Monday, Reverend Jackson traveled to Georgia to sit with the Arbery family, prompting his remarks from attorney Kevin Goff.
Your Honor, I would submit, with all respect to the Reverend Jesse Jackson, that this is no different than bringing in police officers or uniformed prison guards in a small town where a young black man has been accused of assaulting a law enforcement officer or corrections officer.
And students at Howard University have reached a deal that'll bring an end to the protest at one of the nation's preeminent historically black universities. Since October 12th, students have been occupying Howard's Blackburn University Center to demand better campus housing amid reports of toxic mold, pests, and crumbling infrastructure in campus dorms. The students were also demanding better representation and more transparency from Howard administrators. An attorney for the students said while details of the agreement remain confidential, protesters largely accomplished their objectives. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, Afghanistan is facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis as millions face starvation with the winter months quickly approaching. We'll speak to Jan Egeland of the Norwegian Refugee Council, just back from visiting an Afghan refugee camp in Iran. Stay with us.
The father of pan-Africanism, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, says to all black people all over the world, the secret of life is to have no fear. We all have to understand that.
Fear Not for Man by Fela Kuti. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today in Afghanistan, where humanitarian and economic conditions are rapidly deteriorating. On Monday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken held a video call with members of the Afghan Evac Coalition, who said they need more help evacuating tens of thousands of people who could be targeted under the Taliban government, and noted, quote, winter is coming. There's a famine already. The United Nations estimates 60%, that's more than half of Afghanistan's population, now suffer from acute hunger. And the country faces a financial crisis after the U.S. and other Western countries cut off direct financial assistance to the government. Taliban leaders are also unable to access billions of dollars in Afghan national reserves held in banks overseas. The World Food Program Executive Director David Beasley told the BBC Afghanistan is now the worst humanitarian crisis on earth.
It is as bad as you possibly can imagine. In fact, we're now looking at the worst humanitarian crisis on earth. 95% of the people don't have enough food, and now we're looking at 23 million people marching towards starvation. Out of that, almost 9 million are knocking on famine's door. The winter months are coming. We're coming out of a drought. The next 6 months are going to be catastrophic. It is going to be hell on earth.
The UN estimates 500,000 people could flee Afghanistan by the end of the year. Thousands of Afghan refugees are now crossing the border into neighboring Iran. According to the Norwegian Refugee Council, as many as 5,000 Afghans are fleeing into Iran every day. This could set up another crisis in Europe, where the European Union agreed Monday to new sanctions against Belarus for bringing some 4,000 migrants to the border with Poland and leaving them stranded in freezing forests. For more, we're joined by the NRC Secretary General Jan Egeland, who's in Oslo, Norway. He's just returned from a trip to Iran, where he met with Afghan refugees in a refugee camp. He recently tweeted, quote, Iran alone hosts more displaced Afghans than 30 European countries combined. Despite this, nations in the European Championship in erecting barbed wire against refugees give negligible funds for displaced Afghans elsewhere. His recent New York Times op-ed is headlined, Afghanistan is facing a total economic meltdown. Jan Egeland, welcome back to Democracy Now! Describe the scope of the catastrophe in Afghanistan right now and what you think needs to happen.
Well, I was myself recently also in Afghanistan, and I sat down with the mothers in these displacement camps around Kabul, and I asked them, what about the future? What do you think of the future? And they told me very clearly, we believe we will starve and freeze to death this harsh winter. unless there is an enormous aid operation coming through, and unless there is a public sector again that is able to provide services. It is as acute as that. 40 million civilians were left behind when the NATO countries went for the door in August.
But Jan Englund, the NATO countries not only went for the door, they took all of Afghanistan's financial reserves with them as they left. They froze the assets of the Afghan government. Could you talk about the role of this issue of all of the money in Afghanistan essentially being held hostage by the Western nations that left?
Well, yes. I mean, there is a lot of issues over these last 20 years. And one of them is that there was an enormous aid dependency. So 70% of teachers, nurses, doctors, water engineers, garbage collectors, public workers were on the payroll of Western development donors. That was cut overnight. So I met teachers who were eager to restart girls' education and boys' education. They hadn't been paid since May. The banks are paralyzed because of the freezing of assets. So we, NRC, Norwegian Refugee Council, cannot transfer money to our colleagues in Kabul through the local bank system, nor even extract money there to pay salaries for our 2,000 aid workers that did not go for the door, who are there to stay and deliver because of this freezing of the economy. Of course, the Taliban has an enormous responsibility for good governance in the place that they took over. But I sincerely believe the NATO countries mustn't forget they left behind 40 million people.
And also, could you talk about the role of Iran and Pakistan, which have basically shouldered an enormous refugee population, estimates of 3 million Afghans in Iran alone, and the failure of, again, the West to assist these countries in their efforts to assist the refugees?
Yes, indeed. I mean, 90% of Afghan refugees, and there are many millions of them, accumulated over 40 years of fighting since the Soviet invasion in Afghanistan 40 years ago. The 90% of these refugees are in two countries, Iran and in Pakistan. They are not in Europe. They are not in North America. They are not in the rich countries. They are in these two neighboring countries. And in Iran, where I was, refugees are given education and healthcare and so on, but the Iranian host communities are not getting much international assistance at all. So now that 4,000 or 5,000 come over the border every single day, 320,000 since the Taliban took over, I mean, it means that the Afghan refugees in Iran are very afraid of the future because they think that the little they have has to be divided in even smaller portions for all of those coming over the border. There has to be an investment in hope inside Afghanistan, but also in the two neighboring countries.
I want to ask about the conditions in the health centers in Afghanistan. This is an excerpt from a France 24 program which features Hasibullah Barakzai, an administrator at a hospital in Kabul, where patients have to buy their own medicine, gloves and syringes. The clip begins with Masood, a nurse in the hospital.
You see, we don't have any medicine here. We used to have antibiotics, painkillers and vitamins here, but it's empty now. In this cupboard, we had medicine for heart patients. Now we don't even have a tablet left. This water cooler doesn't work anymore. Look, we don't even have water to wash our hands.
We don't have enough food for the patients. Winter is here, and we don't have enough fuel for the heating system.
Afghanistan was already suffering from decades of war, drought, and economic collapse prior to the Taliban Taliban takeover. But now UN officials have been warning of a much worse humanitarian crisis in the country, with 23 million people facing hunger and 9 million on the brink of starvation. Children are bearing the brunt of the crisis. The UN warned that if urgent humanitarian assistance isn't provided, more than a million children will die from malnutrition. The BBC spoke to a mother whose two severely malnourished children were hospitalized.
The pain that he's suffering, I also feel it. Only God knows what I go through when I look at him. Two of my children are facing death because we don't have any money. I want the world to help Afghan people. I don't want any other mother to see their children suffering like this.
Just some of the voices of Afghanistan. Jan Egeland, as Juan just pointed out, when the Taliban toppled Afghanistan's government, the country suddenly lost access to $9 billion in central bank reserves frozen by the Biden administration. For those countries that are saying we will not support the Taliban, so we will not give money, what do you say to them?
Well, I say correct that money should not go to the military political group called the Taliban that took power by force. The money should go to the people, and it is possible. So, number one, there has to be trust funds, as we call it, that is held by UN agencies that funnel money directly to the hospitals that you just showed, that are where people are dying at the moment. It can go straight to the teachers that were on the payroll of the World Bank previously, can go straight to them. So the money can go through us, international organizations, straight to the people. Secondly, unfreeze those funds that will enable banks to function again. At the moment, we cannot even buy relief items in Afghanistan. We have to ship them over, take them over from Pakistan and Iran, which means that that employment is dying in Afghanistan. And thirdly, donors, come down from the fence. See that we are there. We are reliable channels for funding. The money will go to the people. Transmit funding, not just come with pledges. This will not become Switzerland in a long time. You have to share the risk with us to save lives this winter.
And Jan Egeland, I wanted to ask you, isn't it in the interest of the NATO and the Western nations that were in Afghanistan to assure some kind of an orderly government in Afghanistan? Because if the Taliban are not able to deliver basic services to their people, doesn't that give possibility for a rise of even more extremist groups within the country, like ISIS?
That could well be. But anyhow, I would argue that nobody wants an implosion in Afghanistan where 40 million people see, I have no hope here. I need to leave. I mean, it would go that people would then use the neighboring countries as a segue, a channel to go elsewhere, including to Europe, where we have worked ourselves up in a hysteria for a very few thousand migrants on the Polish-EU border. Hundreds of thousands have now assembled at the Iranian-Afghan border on the Afghanian side, with the intent to get over. Iranian refugees I spoke to said, all our relatives have started to wander. They want to come to Iran, and they want to wander towards Europe. So it is in everybody's interest to stabilize things in Afghanistan. And I just listed the three things that can be done. It's not rocket science. It has to happen tomorrow. We have no time, really, before the massive death starts.
I'd like to turn to Hassan Esfandiar of the Iranian Red Crescent, who spoke to Al Jazeera about the difficulties of providing assistance to the thousands of Afghans you just described arriving at the border every day.
Due to the current situation of sanctions, to the country. Unfortunately, we are not able, or we were not able to receive the international donations assistance because the banking channels are blocked, and then we are not able to receive the humanitarian donations. So far, the Iranian Red Crescent tried to provide its own resources for the Afghan displaced populations who are approaching the border. As it is mentioned by your colleagues in the report, the average number of the populations who are approaching the Iranian borders are between 2,000 to 7,000 per day. So it's a huge number.
So Jan Egeland, of course, the U.S. has sanctions against Iran. So how can Iran be helped in dealing with this number of refugees that are crossing the border, 4,000 or 5,000 every day? What's getting the West's attention is what's happening in Eastern Europe. Earlier today, Polish border guards firing tear gas water cannons at hundreds of asylum seekers trying to push their way through razor wire barrier erected along the Poland-Belarus border. That's 4,000 to 5,000 refugees there altogether. What's happening in Iran is every day. So if you could address both, from Iran to Poland-Belarus border.
Well, as a European, I'm ashamed of what's happening in our part of the world. What Belarus is doing by using vulnerable migrants like chess pawns in some kind of a power play, and then Europe basically say we're not going to hear any asylum application at all. In violation of international law, we're going to throw everybody out, and then migrants in some kind of a stalemate with the army on either side wanting them to go in opposing directions. That's Europe with a few thousand. In Iran, we're having between 3.5 and 4 million Afghans at the moment. 3.5 to 4 million. I think that has to be sunk in. 4,000 or 5,000 more per day. And a very small international aid program. Again, the United Nations is there with UNHCR, the refugee agency. NRC is there. We can do more. We need more funding. We also ask for more freedom of operation from the Iranian authorities so we can win this race against the winter on both sides of the border, inside Afghanistan, but also in Iran and in Pakistan. It has to be understood that a lot is at stake. It's not a small catastrophe. It's 23 million people who have no more food. They will wander. I would go if I was in that situation. I would also wander to where I could get food for my children.
And Jan Egeland, in the particular role of the United States in all this, as being the primary power that led the war in Afghanistan for so many years, and then the Biden administration suddenly pulling out. What would you urge the Biden administration to do now?
The U.S. should lead, really, as it has in the military political project over the last 20 years, should lead in the humanitarian relief operation. Unfreeze the assets that is necessary to get the public sector going. The World Bank sits on funds. So when I wrote to the World Bank president, the answer back was, well, we're willing to do things if the member states on our board, the U.S. and others, tell us to release money. We can't release money. It's sitting there for teachers and nurses and hospitals and whatnot in Afghanistan. And also enable us as organizations to really work effectively and efficiently on both sides of the border. Iran sanction is making it difficult for us to work to some extent. And Norwegian Refugee Council couldn't even transfer money for a full year after the Trump administration started these sanctions, because there was no bank with a backbone strong enough to transfer aid money to our people, because they were so afraid of one day coming in court in New York because of a potential break of these sanctions. It is a paralyzing for us who are on the front lines of humanity.
Jan Egeland, the UN Climate Summit just wrapped up in Glasgow with a significantly weakened pact that activists, scientists, many governments say falls far short of what's needed to avert a climate catastrophe. You tweeted, this deal is better than no deal, but far from achieving climate justice and avert disaster displacements, there are too many carbon-spewing spoilers among the negotiators. The fight must now be taken to each and every big polluter. Name names. Talk specifically about what has to be done and how the climate catastrophe generates climate refugees.
Well, I would start actually by going to those who intend to burn a lot of coal now that will lead to in Afghanistan, Iran, that we're talking about, have both massive droughts at the moment. It is climate change fueled. So really, it's the major industrialized nations that has to do most, including China and now India, that are carbon spewing and plan to spew out much more carbon in the coming years. We have to call a spade a spade. Look at where the emissions comes from, and all has to come dramatically down. Afghans, they emit nothing really, and they are the first to starve because of this. The economic chaos and the droughts have created chaos in Afghanistan. Same in the Sahel belt. I was in places like Burkina Faso and Niger and so on. And you see how vulnerable they are. They haven't emitted anything really in recent decades, and they are first and hardest hit.
Jan Egeland, we want to thank you for being with us, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. We'll link to your piece in the New York Times. Afghanistan is facing a total economic meltdown. Speaking to us from Oslo, Norway. Coming up, we look at the U.S.-China summit that took place last night and look more broadly at U.S.-China relations. We'll speak to Alfred McCoy, his new book out today, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. Stay with us. Dawn of the Idols by Howie Lee. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping have spoken for 3.5 hours in a virtual summit Monday night. The meeting took place just days after the U.S. and China announced plans to work together to confront the climate emergency. Tensions been rising between the two nations, with some saying a new Cold War is developing. During the summit, Xi warned Biden supporting Taiwanese independence would be, quote, playing with fire. He also criticized the U.S. for building new alliances in the Pacific region to counter China's rise. Xi said dividing the world into blocks would, quote, inevitably bring disaster to the world. Biden raised concerns about China's human rights record and what the U.S. has described as unfair trade and economic policies. Both leaders spoke publicly as the summit began. This is Xi Jinping.
总统先生, 你好。今天啊, As the world's two largest economies and the permanent members of the UN Security Council, China and the United States need to increase communications and cooperation. We should each run our domestic affairs well and at the same time shoulder our share of international responsibilities and work together for the most noble cause of world peace and development. This is the common aspiration of our people in China and the United States, as well as the people of all countries in the world. And it is also the common mission of the leaders of China and the United States. A sound Chinese-U.S. relationship is required for advancing our two countries' respective development and for safeguarding a peaceful and stable international environment, including finding effective responses to global challenges such as climate change and the COVID pandemic.
And this is President Biden speaking from the Roosevelt Room at the White House at the start of the virtual summit with the Chinese president.
I'm happy we had found time to meet, and I look forward to a candid and forthright discussion like all the discussions we've had thus far. It seems to me our responsibility as leaders of China and the United States to ensure that the competition between our countries does not veer into conflict, whether intended or unintended. It seems to me we need to establish some common sense guardrails to be clear and honest where we disagree and work together where interests intersect, especially on vital global issues like climate change. How our bilateral relationship evolves seems to me to will have a profound impact not only on our countries, but quite frankly, the rest of the world.
Both men were surrounded by each flag of China and the United States. To talk more about the U.S.-China relations, we're joined by Alfred McCoy, professor of history at University of Wisconsin-Madison. His latest book is out today, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. McCoy writes, while Washington was spilling its blood and treasure into desert sands, Beijing had been investing much of its accumulated trade surplus in the integration of the world island of Africa, Asia, and Europe into an economic powerhouse. Alfred McCoy, welcome back to Democracy Now! So if you can talk about this summit, you wouldn't quite understand the kind of tension that is between the United States and China right now, the world's two largest economies. But if you can talk about the significance of this and then how close we are to a Cold War or hot war with China.
The key issue in terms of immediate conflict between Washington and Beijing is Taiwan. As you said earlier, Amy, you know, President Xi of China said that the United States was playing with fire over Taiwan. By way of background, President Xi has committed himself within China to the reunification of Taiwan with China. He wants that to be a critical part of his legacy. And on the other side, President Biden stated just last month in his town meeting that the United States was committed to the defense of Taiwan. So here we have two leaders taking positions over Taiwan, which, if they're fully pursued, will lead to conflict. And this is another problem for the United States. The New York Times has reported that the Pentagon has war-gamed a war over Taiwan between the United States and China. And in the last 18 of these war games, the United States has lost 18 times. China has the world's most sophisticated anti-ballistic missiles, the most sophisticated missile defense. Taiwan is extremely close to China. And if the United States moved aircraft carriers into the Taiwan Straits, like we did in the last conflict back in the 1990s, China could destroy those aircraft carriers. It could sink those aircraft carriers. So the United States, in the immediate future, is faced with the possibility of fighting a war over Taiwan. And if that conflict emerged, the United States would have to either retreat in defeat and see Taiwan conquered, or the United States would have to go to war and fight a war that it would probably lose. And that's one issue, but there's also a deeper geopolitical struggle going on. Over the past five centuries, every world hegemon has done one thing the same way. Every world hegemon, from Portugal to Holland, to Britain, to the United States, and now China, has dominated the Eurasian landmass, which today is home to 70% of the world's population and productivity. And with the $4 trillion that China made by 2014 as a result of its open trade with the United States, China's invested $1.2 trillion in this massive infrastructure, laying down a steel grid of rail, road, and gas pipeline, integrating the vast Eurasian landmass into a single market in which trade and power, as if by natural law, is going to flow towards Beijing. China is also working to break the U.S. geopolitical hold over the Eurasian landmass. During the Cold War, we controlled what are known as the axial ends of Eurasia through the NATO alliance in Western Europe and four bilateral treaties with mutual defense treaties with Japan, South Korea, Philippines, and Australia. And from these two axial positions, we ringed Eurasia with bands of steel, aircraft carriers, jets, fighter bombers to dominate Eurasia. And now China is punching through those circles of steel, breaking the U.S. geopolitical grip over Eurasia and, through the Belt and Road Initiative, consolidating its control. Moreover, China has built 40 ports ringing the Eurasian landmass and the coast of Africa. So the combination of this geopolitical circling of the coastlines of Eurasia, combined with this massive grid of infrastructure across the continent, is placing China in control where it is going to dominate the Eurasian landmass. And that is the key to geopolitical power, has been for the last five centuries and will likely be for the rest of this century as well.
Professor McCoy, I'd like to ask you a couple of things about that. First of all, we talk about China and the U.S. as if they are two separate economic spheres. So often they're regarded that way in competition. But hasn't American capitalism depended for decades on the Chinese working class to produce its goods at low wage levels? So in a growing rift between China and the U.S., which economy is likely to suffer the more profound upheaval?
That's the key difference when people talk about a new Cold War. That's the difference between the old Cold War and the new Cold War, as you absolutely correctly pointed out. Okay, it is the economic interdependence between these two global superpowers. Since 2001, China has integrated its economy into the U.S. supply chain. The two economies are absolutely intertwined. They account arguably for as much as 40% of world trade together. Okay, so there's no way that this is going to be disaggregated. China is economically dependent on its exports to the United States. That's the source of this vast amount of money. The $4 trillion all came primarily from U.S. trade. Simultaneously, the U.S. consumer economy is integrated with Chinese factories. So they're economically interdependent. That's the key difference. On the other hand, the competition is also very, very real. And China is hoping to surpass the United States economically. By the end of this decade, China's economy is going to be, according to PricewaterhouseCoopers, the international accounting firm, going to be at least 50% larger than the U.S. economy. And that is going to give China enormous economic leverage. Moreover, by the end of this decade, I think that they will be able to survive an economic break with the United States because, of course, they're spreading that economic control around the globe. So they are superseding us. In terms of real value, what you can buy for a yuan or a dollar, China's economy is already right now probably larger than the U.S. economy. But by the end of the decade, it'll be clearly larger, at least 50% larger. And from that economic control, China will be able to expand its military in a number of military fields, like any ballistic missiles. They're already ahead of us. They're building their navy. They're going to be working very hard to push us beyond what China calls the first island chain, which America calls the Pacific Littoral, that string of islands off the coast of Asia from Japan through Okinawa, Taiwan, and all the way down to Australia. China wants to push us out of that. They want to push us back to the mid-Pacific. They want to split the Pacific Ocean down the middle. And China's navy is getting to the point where they might be able to do that.
Well, but let me ask you, on this issue of the move toward hegemony, let's say, of the Chinese nation and economy, isn't there a big difference in terms of the use of military force. The last time that I recall China was engaged in a shooting war was more than 40 years ago in Vietnam, or with Vietnam. But in that 40-year period, the United States has been involved in military. This is a declining economic power. Has been involved in military interventions in Panama, Grenada, Libya, Afghanistan, two wars in Iraq, the Balkans, and not to mention all the military attacks and drone strikes in Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan. This is all in the period from which China has had been involved in no military intervention. China has all these ports, but it doesn't have the worldwide military presence that would make it a what would be called an aggressor nation, don't you think?
Well, first of all, your recounting of our recent history is absolutely accurate, of course. Two things about that. First of all, over the last 20 years, the bulk of our military operations, as we all know, has been focused in the greater Middle East. And the strategic logic of that was, in effect, securing the Middle Eastern oil, giving us kind of a permanent presence that will give us absolute access to Middle East oil. And we were doing that at the time when that oil was about to join cordwood and coal as superseded sources of fuel. So we invested $8 trillion, $10 trillion in securing a commodity which was passing into the dustbin of history. Okay, so it was a gross strategic miscalculation. When the history of the U.S. empire is written in 2030, starting in 2030, when it's over, okay, that will probably go down as one of the greatest strategic miscalculations in U.S. history. and then militarily, the point of naval expansion is not so much conflict. Most people don't understand that. Most people think of naval history just in terms of wars. But what do navies do? The oceans are a global commons, and the way that a rising global hegemon secures oceans is through weaving an invisible line of constant patrols and dominance over those open spaces to claim it strategically and also in terms of the minerals and values and fishing beneath the sea to claim that as well. So that's what China is doing. China is weaving those lines of constant patrols by air and sea all the way to the first island chain, pushing us back, building seven island bases in the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea, pushing in the East China Sea. So it's part of an imperial game that's been played for 500 years. And China's doing that quite successfully.
Professor McCoy, you recently wrote a piece for Tom Dispatch headlined, "The Winner in Afghanistan, China." Why do you believe that China has emerged stronger after the U.S. Withdrawal from Afghanistan? Talk about what geopolitical role Afghanistan plays and the difference in how the U.S. Engaged in this forever war in Afghanistan and China's relationship with it.
Sure. In terms of President Xi's strategy, which he announced in 2013 under the Belt and Road Initiative, what he was going to do and what he's been doing is turning the vast Eurasian landmass into a single market linked by infrastructure. And if you will, the kind of hole in the donut, crude metaphor, apologies, the hole in the donut was Afghanistan. All right. In terms of that network of massive natural gas pipelines going across the heart of Central Asia, the one connection that couldn't be made was from Central Asia down to the energy deficit areas of Pakistan and India. And that had to pass through Afghanistan. And by ringing Afghanistan with the gas pipelines to the north, the China-Pakistan economic corridor to the east, and then just this year, a massive economic agreement between China and Iran to build rail and gas pipelines. In effect, China surrounded Afghanistan with these lines of steel and was just waiting for Afghanistan to fall into its hands without a shot fired. And in July, a month before the Taliban took power, they sent a top-level delegation to China and met with China's foreign minister. And they worked out an agreement that the Taliban would promote and allow Chinese investment. And there's another great prize in Afghanistan. Geologists estimate that there's about $1 billion of rare earth minerals critical for the construction of lithium batteries, which are going to fuel our transport and much of our reserve power as we switch from fossil fuels to solar power. That Afghanistan has $1 billion of rare earth minerals that are very valuable to China and indeed to the whole international economy. And China will begin developing those in conjunction with the Taliban. So, in effect, China just sat back, surrounded Afghanistan with its geopolitical network, and waited for it to fall right into its hands. And they didn't pay at all. And we spent $8 trillion on Afghanistan and got nothing. It was
and
a
Professor McCoy, Professor McCoy, I wanted to ask you, in this conflict between China and the United States, these two countries are not alone, obviously. The Belt and Road Initiative is meant to win friendship and support to China from other parts of the world. I'm wondering if you would talk about countries like Russia and Iran, you mentioned, in terms of where they would stand in a developing conflict with the United States, and also about Latin America, which China has probably been the only major power to make significant inroads into a continent or an area of the world that used to be considered the U.S. backyard.
Sure. First of all, in Latin America, China has an explicit strategy of resource development with Latin America, and its trade with our own southern neighbors is already larger than our own. China, the core of China's strategy is what the father of modern geopolitics, a British geographer named Sir Halford Mackinder, called the World Island. And he looked at the map in an article in 1904, over 100 years ago, and he said, let's look at the map critically. And he said, what we see is that there are three continents that are close together that form the World Island, Europe, Asia, and Africa, right? And he said, whoever dominates the pivot region, the heart in Central Asia of this World Island, dominates the world. And from his perspective, these three continents were the core of geopolitical power. And then there were some small outlying islands like Greenland and North America and South America. So China, part of China's strategy has been, and actually this dates back all the way to the 1970s, to very seriously develop Africa and to bring Africa into the world economy through Chinese aid, development, and trade links. And at the same time during the Cold War that we were playing a 20-year game in Angola, okay, to disrupt and break the Marxist government there, which didn't work in the end, and we were allied with apartheid South Africa, China was building the Tanzan Railroad from Tanzania, ultimately across the breadth of Africa, its first major international development aid project. And so China, from that basis, all the way back to the 1970s, built relations with the liberation governments, which are now, of course, the main governments in the southern half of Africa. And so China's brought Africa very much into the international economy. China is by far and away the key investor in Africa. You know, we regard Africa as, you know, kind of a band-aid, and we have, and it's very well motivated, of course, but again, we see sort of Africa as a charity case. China, by contrast, sees charity as Africa as a key to its emerging world power. It's the home to nearly a third of humanity, enormous amount of natural resources, potential markets. So China is building a very close relationship with Africa as a part of this tri-continental world island strategy to dominate the core of humanity, the core of the modern economy.
Finally, Professor McCoy, I wanted to end in a different place, but there may be a connection, and that's the insurrection of January 6th. You write in another piece about how this reminded you of a coup you witnessed in the Philippines decades ago.
Yeah. In 1986, I was in the Philippines, and one of my sources in the Philippine military tipped me off that the Marcos government, the Marcos had fled into exile in Hawaii, and the great people power uprising of a million Filipinos in the streets of Manila had established a new democracy.
We have 30 seconds.
His loyalists met, and they seized the Manila Hotel, and they shook Philippine democracy to the point that there were a succession of major coups, armed coups, that really shook Philippine democracy. And what I learned from this is that democracy is very fragile. And that January 6 uprising in Washington, D.C. was a coup, and it has shaken our democracy to the core. And we have to be very serious about reconstructing our democracy after that episode.
We will leave it there, but so many other issues to discuss. Alfred McCoy, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His newest book is out today. It's called To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. Happy belated birthday to Kieran Krug-Meadows and Ishmael Darrow. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Costs, podcast and broadcast distribution, and more. Go to waywardradio.org/donate to help Away with Words today. Thank you.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. On our Facebook group, BC Cornish asks, is there a phrase or word in English that conveys the idea of buying an object and then using the object for a lesser purpose or an unintended purpose, e.g. buying a treadmill and then using it to hang clothes? And Grant, I don't know that there's one singular word for that kind of experience, but it does remind me of a really cool Japanese expression that I came across just the other day, which is mikabosu. And mikabosu literally means three-day monk. And it refers to the kind of person who starts an idea, you know, they get all excited about something. Maybe they buy a language app and they're going to become fluent in this or that language. Or they get all excited about some fitness program or diet, and then they're only on it for 3 days. The idea in Japanese is that, you know, somebody gets excited about becoming a monk, but they can only last for 3 days. Mikabosu. I love that term.
Oh, I know that. I know. My son goes through that with video games. He makes a list. He watches videos about video games. He learns the ones that are great. He decides what he wants. He figures it out. He saves his money. He obsesses about when it's going to arrive. It arrives. And then he just plays it for as many hours as we'll let him. And then he's done. But it's not just the video game. It's the whole process that he enjoys. He enjoys figuring out the games, discovering what other people think about it, deciding which ones to buy, making the list of games, ranking them, then buying it. So it's a whole, he's a three-day monk about the whole process.
And then he's on to the next thing, right?
Yeah, he's a three-day monk about the next game.
Yeah.
You have your weird obsessions. We have ours. What are your weird language obsessions? 877-929-9673. Or just share your thoughts and stories about how you communicate with the world. Email us words@waywardradio.org or talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hello, I'm Corinne, and I'm joined by my student Mara, and we are calling from the University of North Alabama.
Oh, excellent. Well, welcome to the show. So you're here with a student. What are you teaching?
Well, I teach in the Academic English Program. We help international students develop their English language skills as they prepare to enter a degree program here at the university.
Oh, lovely.
Well, what's on your mind today?
Well, recently in speaking class, Mara was demonstrating a recipe, and she referred to peanut butter, but she used a term that I had never heard before. She called it peanut leg. And I asked her about that, and she immediately spelled it for me, and it was, as I suspected, L-E-G. And she explained that, as far as she knows, it's common usage in her home country, which is the Democratic Republic of Congo. But I did a quick internet search and just wasn't able to find any easy answers to my questions. I'm curious about the origin of the expression and also how widespread it is.
So peanut butter as peanut leg, L-E-G. All right, we've got to talk to Mara about this.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi, Mara. How are you?
Fine. How about you?
We are good. Tell us about the expression peanut leg. Where did you learn that, or where did you hear that?
Yes, I was translating from Google, and then I just saw the translation like that.
Ah, so you were translating from French.
Yes, because in French we say pâte de hachide, which means peanut leg. Like, it's the same meaning.
Yeah. Oh, Google tricked you, Mara. Google has let you down. Google failed you. Because what you're saying in French is pâte de hachide, which means peanut paste. And it's spelled P-A-T-E. And there's a circumflex, a little hat on the A. And in French words, that means it used to be spelled with an S. So it used to be